The interesting work about healing energy and in the energy healing experiments, Dr. Gary Schwartz talks about it, is that these are things which we don't necessarily see, but we can feel. So is it part of our ordinary world on a day-to-day basis, or is it an extraordinary part of our world into which we rarely actually travel? I'd like to talk about that amongst about a billion other things with Dr. Gary Schwartz. But first, let's establish your credentials if we can, Dr. Schwartz, okay? I have are you still with the University of Arizona?
That's correct.
All right. Just say check next to everything that you are either at least conversant in, if not an expert in, okay? Psychiatry,
Yes.
healing energies,
Yes.
medicine,
A bit.
automotive repair,
Not at all.
okay. Neurology.
What'd you say, neurology? Yes.
Neurology,
Yes.
okay. Psychiatry.
That you already asked? You just checked
Yes.
to see if I give a
Oh, wait.
consistent
Yeah,
answer.
exactly. I was just
Yes.
trying to fool you.
Thank you.
Interpretive dance.
Actually, I once did a study on interpretive dance.
See? I'm telling you, I was just throwing these out thinking there's no way, but okay, so I got one. Interior design.
Not at all.
Okay. Surgery.
It's a little.
Surgery, a little bit. All right.
Yes.
So, as I understand it, you're a professor for just about everything at University of Arizona except English and French. Is
And
that
also
fair? To,
not interior design.
and not interior design.
That's correct.
But this is part of why this is such a unique opportunity to talk about something like this with you. Lots of people can put this on a website. A lot of people can, just kind of give you a feeling that they have while they're, taking money from you at a storefront somewhere. But to have somebody with the credentials that you have and the amount of time that you've put into the subject, that is what's going to make this show tonight. We'll get to it right away. The energy healing experiments, and we'll talk about the transplants coming up next with Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Gary Schwartz, it should probably just be a matter of course. I'll admit up front that I grew up in a household which was very friendly to the discussion of healing energies.
Oh.
So it's not a leap at all for me to consider these sorts of things. I haven't always seen the proof of those beliefs, but I'm always open to them. So I just loved your book.
Well, that's fantastic. I sort of wish that I had grown up in a home that was open to this. I mean, for me, this was a very much a surprise that I would end up doing work in this area, or that we'd actually end up doing experiments that would actually provide such positive evidence for the phenomenon.
Well, and there's lots of these test results and other things that I want to get to, and I know that the phones are going to be jammed for you too coming up later on. So I want to make the most of the time that I have with you. Let me start with that the premise though. You got into this how? I mean, you come into medicine from a fairly traditional background. How did you first kind of cross the line into this area, which some people would consider, parapsychological or paranormal?
Sure. Well, I think part of it comes from the conventional, if you would, physics and electrical engineering, and part of it comes from a circumstance of actually meeting some healers and witnessing some phenomena that I just couldn't, I couldn't even have imagined it. My earliest experience was actually when I was a child. I was 6 or 7 years old, and my parents had just gotten a new television set. And this was a long time ago. This was one of those black and white television sets, in a wooden box.
Sure.
And they used do you remember rabbit ears?
Of course. I still have them. I have a set with still has rabbit ears.
Really, that's
Yeah.
fantastic.
Thank you.
And you probably remember or know of that in those days we had a lot of channels, like maybe two or three.
Right. Yeah.
And if you were going to change the channel, you actually had to get up out of your chair
Right.
to turn the dial. This was a long time ago. And one of the things I observed as a kid was when I walked near the television set, that the image would often get distorted. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. I was a curious kid. And so I started playing with the rabbit ears antenna and noticed that there was a wire and it was screwed into the back of the TV. And my father had a toolbox and I knew where it was. And so I took out a screwdriver and I unscrewed the wire. Of course, the picture disappeared. And then I took my finger and I touched the screw, on the back of the TV.
Sure.
And then I looked at the TV in the front of the picture. And to my amazement, I saw the picture return. I let go of my finger, and the picture disappeared. And I reattached my finger, and the picture reappeared. I did it over and over, and I realized that I was serving as a rabbit ears. I was somehow serving as an antenna for signals I could not see, I could not imagine. And yet, I was part of the process. Now, being, again, a questioning kid, I didn't know if this was real or not. My parents had an AM radio. Again, it was one of those old radios, a big one with a big dial, wooden box. And it had a long wire that was hid behind the couch. I unscrewed that wire, and the sound disappeared. Music disappeared. I touched the back of the screw, and lo and behold, the music appeared. So what happened was I had, so to speak, a scientific, mystical experience with this realization that somehow I, and therefore everyone else, was serving as an antenna and even potentially a receiver for invisible signals that I couldn't imagine. So I think what started me on the road to being interested in science and being interested in energy, particularly invisible energy, was that very early childhood experience.
And how many years later was it while did you still have to stand there and be a human antenna for your father?
Well, in some respects, it's never ended.
And that's how you got into psychiatry. We're still dealing with all of those issues.
Exactly. That's very funny. But but it really wasn't until many years later, when I was an established, scientist. I had, I had done my PhD at Harvard. I had been a professor at Harvard and also at Yale, and then moved to the University of Arizona. And it wasn't until after that that I started witnessing healing. I had never thought that I'd actually be using this in a healing context. And I describe in the Energy Healing Experiments book, for example, an experience I had with a healer who I call Suzanne in the book, on the East Coast. And she was actually a clinical psychologist who was just learning about healing touch. This was in the mid-1990s. And a patient of hers called, very upset. It was a lawyer, and her husband had fallen off the roof. And he was in an emergency room, and he was in severe pain. And so Suzanne went to the hospital, and I was invited to come along. And he was in a room by himself, hadn't had any medication yet, hadn't been x-rayed, severe pain. And Suzanne said to me, she said, Gary, would you mind taking his wife out and giving her some comfort? And I'm going to see if I can do some healing energy with him. Of course, I didn't know what this was. So I took the gentleman's wife out. But I positioned her in such a way that I could look over her shoulder to see what Suzanne was doing. And I noticed that Suzanne was, for example, taking her hands, not touching the man's body, but just sort of passing it over his head and other parts of his body. And then she took her hand and she and sort of waved it near the man's wrist. She actually took her finger, I later learned it's called the laser technique, and pointed it and actually drilled. And the image that I had when she was sort of drilling in the air was, what happens when you take your finger and you put it near your head as if somebody's crazy?
Right.
So that's the image that I had. Anyway, I came back into the room 15 minutes later with the wife, and there is the man smiling like a Cheshire cat. And he had claimed that his pain had virtually disappeared. Virtually disappeared. Now, no, he was not about to play tennis. He ultimately did have a broken wrist. But his pain had vanished. And the question that I had was, where did his pain go? Was this just some sort of massive placebo effect? Was this would have just have gone away by itself? Or was Suzanne doing something with her energy and with her consciousness that was contributing to his pain relief?
But now, in a way, aren't those kind of two different things? Okay. I mean, the idea of, with energy, reading your book too, I was just fascinated with the different versions of different approaches you had to this, but let's just stay with the energy.
Sure.
If it's something that she's transmitting
right
from her body to his body at a cellular level,
right,
that's one thing. But the conscious part of it too can be something else, can't it? I mean, just the very thought, for example, just I'll talk off the top of my head, that she was there and caring for him,
right,
and demonstrating affection and no fear of his injuries and calming him and distracting him from his pain. Could that not just be enough to increase, say, his natural endorphin level and therefore making the pain go away?
Absolutely. In fact, that was one of the fundamental questions Was it just simply her loving and comforting presence? Or was it something more than that? Was it actually involving her energy and maybe even her conscious intentions, which, by the way, and at a later point in the book I talk about this, where she could actually be doing this long distance with the, you know, healings where, and I report this early in the book, where healings could take place hundreds or thousands of miles away, and where the, even in certain cases where the patient isn't even conscious that the healing intentions are being provided.
And that speaks to the E. coli experiment in your book, which we can go back to, too. But I want to make that point. That there's something about her demeanor that adds to the effect. And so when you say, is it a placebo effect, would it be unfair to call it a placebo effect if he feels like he's getting better because he just likes the feeling of being around her?
Yes, we should define what placebo means. That's what psychiatrists or psychologists typically call it, but really it's any factor that is relates to belief or relates to the people's awareness of the social experience. In other words, it's the, if you would, the psychological side of healing as opposed to a possible energetic side as well. And as you know, what the book does is actually, much to my amazement, discovers that there's more to human relationship than just the psychology of our relationship, but there's an actual energetic role as well.
The physiology of our relationships.
The physiology of a relationship, but also the actual invisible energy of the relationship.
Right, right. But and that's where the thing is, that on this is what we're really talking about is something that is not otherworldly. It's just this worldly. We just don't. We spend a lot of time with it. We don't think about it. We're
exactly.
not open
it's the
to
same
it.
Thing. That's why I go back to the TV signals, okay, or the fact that I'm in Tucson, Arizona. Where are you located?
I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Okay. And somehow we are communicating over long distance, and probably some of this communication is certainly to your listeners going out over the, quote, radio waves.
Right.
This is not otherworldly. This is obviously part of our natural environment. But those signals are, quote, invisible. They're invisible to our senses. And until radio was discovered, we never knew that there were these invisible means by which energy and information could transmit over long distances.
Yeah, but there's something about that, the fact that what you're doing here with the work is quantifiable. You can measure it. You can,
absolutely.
Like any good scientist, you can repeat the results, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the difference between just somebody handing you a stone and or a crystal and saying, here, this is all you need. There's and or charging you a lot of money for something, which in the end, you kind of didn't feel like there really was any appreciable difference in your life. There's something about what you're doing, which is just, it really kind of puts a handle on it for a lot of people out there who would never have given this another thought.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we do in this book is we lay out a whole series of real experiments, you know, not just with healers, but with normal everyday folks, including undergraduate students,
yeah.
And actually study to what extent, for example, can one person objectively measure the energy of another person, sense the energy of another person.
And I'm sorry, since when are undergraduate students normal people? I don't know, when did that happen?
I have to put normal in quotes.
When did that happen? When I was in school? Do they suddenly straighten up after I left? Is that it?
Yeah, well, I hopefully they're as, quote, unnormal as your listenership, which
okay.
is probably among the more creative of our population.
I think so, too. And all right, so let's talk about one of these experiments. Give an example of a kind of experiment you could do that would prove that, you know, you gave your observation about the woman and your friend, and that's cool. But all right, so let's where did the rubber hit the road on this? How can you prove that her twirling of her finger over an injury would create some sort of subatomic healing process?
Okay. Well, let's start with the first question, which is whether or not, for example, if we move our hands or move any part of our body in a particular way, are we actually generating an electromagnetic field? Is that electromagnetic field, does that travel across from one person to another? And can the other person serve as an antenna for this kind of a signal? And I describe in the book experiments we did where we actually had people under controlled conditions moving their hands a fixed distance in space, up and down, I think it was 3 or 4 inches. The exact distance is not important at this moment. And they would move it up and down, over an electrode box, which is where, for example, EEG electrodes would be attached. So notice right now what we're doing is we're dealing with the electrode box itself. There are no electrodes actually attached to the box. The box is just sitting there. But that box, by wire, of course, is plugged into this very sensitive microvolt amplifier. And what we predicted was that due to what's called an electrostatic body motion effect, that when a person would move their hand up and down, that this would actually create a magnetic field. And that magnetic field would actually be picked up, would travel through the air, reach the place where the holes were, where the wire would actually plug in. It would then be carried by the wire into the amplifier, because remember, this electrode box has wires that go into the input of the amplifiers. And then this would actually be displayed on the screen. And you could actually document very beautifully that to move is to create an electromagnetic field. Now, once you've documented that that occurs, and that's easily replicable, then the next thing to do is the question is, to what extent can another person actually be picking up that signal? So, for example, when you move your hand, let's say, up and down over a person's head, does their head actually pick up that signal? And is that signal transferred through the person's body? And we actually did experiments where we show one of the things that happens with normal electrical signals is that it decreases with what's called the square of the distance. In other words, the further you move away from an antenna, the smaller the signal is that reaches the antenna. And you can actually show that it decreases over distance, which we did. Then what we did was we showed that if a subject, in this case the antenna person, took and put their hands over the antenna, over the electrode box, but we're not touching it. And now the sender waved his hand up and down, either over the person's head or over their other hand that was 3 or 4 feet away from the actual antenna box, you would see a dramatic increase in the size of the signal, which then told us that the person was actually receiving the signal, not just the one who was generating it, but the other person was receiving it. It was traveling through their body and then being picked up by the actual electromagnetic amplifiers. So here we're starting with a very simple but elegant way to verify that these signals are connecting us all the time. And this is just one of a variety of electrical signals which most of us are aware of. By the way, one of my all-time favorite experiences was, which is again, of course, this is now an anecdote, but it's easy to replicate, was that I was wanting to see how many different kinds of amplifiers could pick up these signals. And as I'm sure you're aware, there are now miniaturized digital, for example, EEG or EKG amplifiers that are used in biofeedback, and they can plug into a normal PC. And you can actually use these kind of amplifiers. They only cost a couple of $100. And I wanted to try one of these myself. And I was doing this in my study with a former colleague of mine. And she was on the other end of the room, and I was serving. She was the sender, and I was the antenna. And we were getting results. And then her little dog came into the room. He was a little West Highland white terrier, whose name, by the way, was Freudy. It was actually Freudy the Second. And Freudy walks into the room, and the amplifiers saturate. I mean, it completely went off the scale. And I said to Freudy, I said, "Freudy, sit down. You're making a huge signal." Of course, I sort of talked to dogs like I talked to people.
Right.
I don't know what he understood. I mean, he understood sit, obviously. So there he sat down, and his tail was wagging. And as his tail was wagging back and forth, I saw the signal on the computer screen. I was serving as an antenna.
That's where we'll have to leave it for there, but I'll come right back and pick it up right there, Dr. Gary Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. So far, it's kind of an all 80s weekend, as Kiris just pointed out, on Coast to Coast AM. Kind of a coincidence. But you know what? As we're continuing to sort of poke at this subject of healing energy. You never know what's going to come up between now and the end of the show. I want to get back to the transplant stories, and we just heard about the tail wagging of the dog as it was being picked up by the equipment being used by Dr. Gary Schwartz. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I want to let you know that during the break, I finally was able to get my blog linked at coasttocoastam.com. So if you go to coasttocoastam.com, go to the lower left-hand corner, you'll see a tab there that'll take you to the blog. If you missed crypto news tonight, you can pick it up right there. A couple of interesting stories all pertaining to exactly what's going on outside in the real world. Or is it more of an unreal world, a world that we too often take for granted, that we think that just because we can't see something that it doesn't really exist? These energy fields, which, come on, we hear about all the time, and people wearing scarves and, you know, and state fairs and all this other stuff. Can you really trust it? Can you really believe it? Well, I think you can really believe Dr. Gary Schwartz, University of Arizona professor, as he continues his research into that and where it'll take us into the future, too. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so you were talking about doing this experiment with a former colleague in which you were measuring energy fields that were going back and forth between you when her dog, Freudie, came in and wagging Freudie's tail. What did you see, Dr. Schwartz?
Well, literally, the wagging of his tail, just like the movement of our hands, and this was over 10 feet distance, the wagging of his tail was actually being shown as a wave on the computer that was being received by my body and then being transmitted by my body to the electrode box and then to the computer. Now, why that was important to me personally was that, you know, we hear all kinds of stories about how the presence of animals, for example, can have healing effects on people. There's all these stories about that we receive comfort and love and so on.
Sure.
We don't typically entertain the idea that literally when a dog, for example, shows us joy and, so to speak, wags every cell in its body, that what it's actually doing is generating a massive, by biological standards, electromagnetic field that we're being bathed in. And this field is actually providing us with a signal that is helping us to equilibrate our bodies, to become coherent around that signal. And so for me, it was just an instance of an experience, you know, where I was actually picking up not just anyone's hand movements or whatever, but literally every animal. I mean, I talk about, for example, in the book how, you know, we see a bird flying even near us, and it's fluttering its wings, and we think we're separated from that bird. But that bird's flapping of its feathers is actually generating an electromagnetic field that we are picking up. And we, in turn, when we move, we're generating a signal. Even our breathing generates a signal that's going back to the bird.
You know,
but the take-home message here is that we're all connected by these invisible electromagnetic fields, and that's the first step in the logical train of being able to establish that we can affect one another energetically.
See, and I always thought it was the medicinal effect of dog slobber. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I think that there's something about, you know, the idea of when a dog or a puppy, I mean, you look at you say it's kind of a breakthrough idea. It certainly is, until you consider Charlie Brown's classic poster, Happiness is a Warm Puppy.
Absolutely. You know, all this is doing is providing a scientific way of measuring these effects and taking it one step further. By the way, someday somebody should do the dog slobber experiments.
Oh, they should. And you know what? I'll even throw you one a little bit more. I would love to have seen what the results would have been had you had your eyes closed while the dog was wagging his tail.
Well, I did that. I closed my eyes as well.
Did
as
you?
Yes, it makes no difference.
It made no difference because I would think, again, then that excludes the idea that visually seeing if you see a dog wag its tail, that you are, it makes you happy, and therefore it gave you a different result.
Right.
Okay, very cool. Well, but see, now let me ask you about the difference then between good energy and bad energy. Let's say that it had been a dog there, an angry dog that was not wagging his tail and was instead just standing there growling.
Yes, or an angry person.
Or an angry person.
Right. Well, since you mentioned the E. coli experiments, let's mention that briefly because there's a perfect example where the energy of the healer is unknowingly affecting whether or not cells live or die in an experiment where they're actually trying to produce healing. Shall we talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's a great example of that because I think this is where, again, it comes down to even just going to visit your neighborhood-friendly general practitioner. You can end up not being as – you can come out of a doctor's office feeling worse depending on what mood they're in, and they're just treating you with, you know, pills or potions of some sort.
Exactly, and that this may be mediated – not just psychologically, but energetically. So here's the experiment. My colleagues and I were doing research to see whether or not Reiki, which is a particular form of energy healing that comes out of Japan, whether Reiki could affect E. coli bacteria in test tubes, which had been exposed to heat stress, which actually we titrated it so that 50% of the cells were killed by the particular temperature of heat. And then we were looking to see to what extent they were growing back and reaching their normal colony level of population of cells of bacteria. And there were a group of test tubes that the healers were treating. Of course, they never touched them. They were actually put in a container, so they couldn't actually physically touch the bacteria, obviously. And there was a control. There were a set of test tubes in another part of the laboratory that were untreated. And the after the Reiki practitioners would treat the bacteria, the cells were then prepared to be.
Well, but how did they treat the bacteria? What did they do? What did the Reiki practitioners do to the tube with the E. coli that had been heated? What did they do to it?
Well, what they did was for 15 minutes, they would sit in front of the tubes, and they would, quote, run Reiki energy. They would, quote, with their consciousness, send Reiki energy to these tubes, in the case of Reiki, for, quote, the best and highest good for the cells, which was presumed to allow them to recover. And so they were attempting to, heal these injured bacteria. And they would do the same thing as they did with a person. Now, this was a blind experiment because after the test tubes were collected, they were then scored blindly, meaning the person who was actually doing the assays did not know which were the treated and which were the controls. And each practitioner was brought in for multiple days. Okay, now the prediction was that Reiki would on the average actually increase the rate of cell growth, i.e., the population would recover. And what we discovered was that this happened some of the time, but sometimes the cells went in the reverse direction. They were actually doing worse. They were, quote, dying. And the question is, why was that happening? Now, one of the things that I did was I requested that each time a healer would enter the laboratory, they would fill out a simple questionnaire where they would rate their physical and emotional and spiritual well-being. On what we call the Arizona Integrative Outcome Scale, simple 0 to 10 scale, and of course some practitioners on some days came into the laboratory relaxed, happy, grounded, well, and so on. But other days and other practitioners, they'd come in, they were stressed, or they were depressed, or they were physically tired, or they weren't feeling well, or they had a fight with their child, or with their boyfriend or girlfriend or whomever. And the question was, to what extent did the emotional state and sense of well-being of the healer influence how successful they were in providing Reiki for healing? And what we discovered, to my amazement, was that if they came into the lab feeling well, reporting themselves well and relaxed and so on, the bacteria showed a positive result. But if they came into the lab feeling stressed, having negative emotions, the bacteria actually did worse. They were actually, quote, dying. Now, what's interesting about this is that Reiki practitioners like to believe that their emotional state doesn't matter, that all that matters is their intention. So if they come in and they're working with someone and they just send this healing energy, that their emotional state isn't going to affect this. But these cells were actually picking this up. And remember, the cells in this case, they don't know Reiki from Shmeiki. You know,
right.
They don't have any belief system here. In fact, they couldn't even see the practitioner because they were in an enclosed container. So
they don't have eyes.
And they don't have, they don't have what we call eyes, certainly.
Right. Yeah, but
they
come
can
on.
Pick up the electromagnetic signals.
Right.
That's what's important.
And that was, so what we get from that is that bad energy kills and good energy can create life. And that's one small experiment that seems to affirm that basic principle.
Yes. And what's interesting is it wasn't designed to find that. That's just how the data actually came out. And of course, you don't want to generalize and therefore say, well, gee, if my doctor's in a bad mood, you know, I'm going to have a heart attack as opposed to have a cardiac recovery. It's not, you know, that simple. But on the other hand, what we can wonder about, and we should talk about this later, about what happens when we do long-distance collective studies where you have hundreds or thousands of people sending an intention that where the intention is combined. Under what circumstances can you have powerful, not just positive effects, but negative effects? And we have to be open to that. I mean, the truth is, energy is like a surgeon's knife. That knife can be used either for curing or killing. So it's not the energy itself is not, quote, necessarily, quote, good or bad per se, but rather how it's used, and of course the frequencies that are therefore imposed on that energy, and can be either healing or destroying.
Well, see, I don't know that I mean, here I am telling you, you're professor of everything except math at Arizona. But I mean, how can you say that it's not the energy per se? When in the end, I think it's very clear because we can just sort of feel this intuitively. You can be standing next to somebody who's having a bad day,
right,
and you can feel that energy from them, and it doesn't feel good.
No. Let me. You're absolutely right. Let's clarify this. When I say it's not the energy per se, the term energy here is being used fairly loosely.
Okay.
Because there's the word energy, which is the in physics is defined as the capacity to do work and overcome resistance, which
okay.
is a very vague general definition.
Sure is.
Okay, and then there is information, which is frequency or pattern, which is carried on the energy. So, for example, the reason why you can hear me and I can hear you is because the carrier wave that is actually quite a high frequency, much higher than our voice, that wave is then being modulated by the frequencies of our voice, right?
Right.
And so what matters in this case, if I tell you I love you or I hate you, those two different words have very different effects on people, not because of, quote, the energy per se, but it's the information that's riding on the energy.
Okay.
When I say that what we mean by negative energy is negative information that's riding on the energy.
Okay.
So that's just a linguistic but it's an important one here.
Right. And I wonder how because you said about the information, and I wonder whether you could do an experiment on that by having somebody speak to you in a foreign language that you don't understand, and with the nicest, sweetest voice and all of the lovely physical characteristics tell you that they hate you.
Absolutely. And vice versa. And by the way,
yeah.
I've actually done some research that's related to this. This was actually more than 15 years ago when I was a professor at Yale, in the area of what's called repression. And what happens is there's a disconnect between what a person says and the way that they say it. So if you ask someone, are you angry? And the person
right.
says, I'm not angry.
Right.
Well, the words are saying one thing, but the tone of voice is saying something else. And in this case, they're not aware of their tone of voice.
Right.
Now, what's interesting about this is imagine for the moment that you can't even hear the person. Imagine that you're in another room, for example, and this person is now saying to you, but you're not allowed to hear or see, but the person is you know, describing the thing, you know, I'm not mad at that person.
Right.
Again, even though you're not even there, you can't hear it, you can't see it, will you actually pick up the negative intention of the underlying, you know, tone of voice and so on, which you can't hear? And what our research suggests is yes, because that's the same thing as, so to speak, as what the E. coli bacteria were responding to.
Well, and the E. coli bacteria experiment was most interesting to me when we considered that we all have E. coli in us.
Yes.
Every day, and that it's the right balance of E. coli in our systems, which is essential for digestion and for measuring whether or not the restaurant's any good. And right, it's our own God's natural rating system. And so if we have this, I mean, and we're in balance, we have this sort of symbiotic relationship with the E. coli that's in our system.
Right.
And so that brings us to the idea of this the cellular memory to me, in a way, of the things that your body does or things that your body systems maintain that you're not even aware of, and the possibility of energy being disconnected from your body and still continuing to emanate your own aura. I mean, is that too kooky to say it like that?
No, but I'd like you to take it one step further and tell me what the implication you're leading to.
Well, I want to get to the transplant thing here coming up in a minute. But I also want to even just get to the subject of, and people have talked about this, the idea of ghost limbs, right? When they've lost, say, a leg or even a finger, and they still feel that finger.
Yes.
And I mean, that to me is sort of follows right along this line.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that's very interesting is that, you know, what they call phantom limbs or, you know, ghost
right.
limbs, is the way neurology typically attempts to explain this is that your sensory cortex still has a memory for the limb, even though it's not there. And so what's happening is you're simply having an illusion. It's an hallucination that your limb is no longer present. What they don't entertain is the possibility that literally the energy and information of the limb is still present. And there's actually been some research published where they did some research where they attempted to test whether or not a person could tell, a person who had an amputated arm, for example, if they were blindfolded, and then an experimenter put his or her hand near the amputated limb
right.
versus not near the limb. Could they tell? Could the limb that wasn't there, still having all this energy and sensitivity, the quote aura or the field, and we'll talk about that later if you would like when we talk about the
transplant
plant aura research that I've done.
Right. I can't wait to talk about that.
Yeah, which we've actually measured these kinds of things, that they could actually tell whether somebody was near their phantom limb or not, which is now telling us that somehow they are registering. Their limb is registering the presence of the energy. That's what the implication is.
Because your cerebral cortex can't have a memory of somebody else's hand near your stump.
Absolutely not.
Right. So that would make sense up to that point. And then I would love, well, we'll get into this. We'll take this where it'll go coming up in just a minute with Dr. Gary Schwartz. Again, we're talking about his book about the healing energy experiments that he's been involved with and the results, and the very fascinating results. I too want to get into the discussion of people who have been contacted from the dead. I have had some experiences with that. I'd love to run by you and but more specifically about the transplants. Is it possible that transplant recipients will change their characteristics, their personality? Can they see different changes in their own body because of the person that was a donor for their organ or such? Next on Coast to Coast AM.